Hello and welcome to Sense in Numbers, a podcast created and hosted by two people who have varying levels of experience in mental health issues. We are not mental health professionals, we just want to create a format for people to listen, share and find support in. Each episode will concentrate on different aspects of mental health illness, treatment and experience.
We also feel it pertinent to deliver a trigger warning due to the subject matter of the podcast. You may hear some distressing details and stories. There will also be some mature language and possibly my squeaky crying voice. So listener discretion is advised.
Gemma's got a pea head, a pea head, a pea head. Gemma's got a pea head and the headphones look massive. Hello and welcome to episode 2 of Sense in Numbers. My name is Benjamin.
Nobody calls you Benjamin.
I'm calling myself Benjamin today. Bodjubud. What's your name? And why are you in my house? Sorry, why am I in your house?
My name is Gemma.
Hello, Gemma.
I am your wife.
Hello, Gemma. Are you good?
I'm grand.
I didn't think we'd reach the giddy heights of a second episode.
Like you didn't think you'd still be here, or you just didn't think anybody would listen to it?
A bit of both. Oh, we joke. Yeah, it's good to be recording our second episode. I thoroughly enjoyed the last one. We'll share some of the delightful feedback we've had later on in the episode.
Yeah.
But for now, we're just going to let you know what's coming up. We have our usual, that's not true, mate. We also have Shut up.
We're going to have to call it something else.
Preposterous past procedures. Is that what we called it last week?
Something like that.
What did you say? You said something, some past.
Preposterous.
No, you said something very simple. It was very catchy and it was easier to say than that.
Potty past procedures.
No, it's the procedures I don't like.
Oh, sorry.
Anyway, we've got a section where we talk about some old procedures that are ridiculous. I don't know what Gemma's going to talk about, but I'm very much looking forward to it because all day she's been going, I can't wait to tell you. So yeah, I'm looking forward to that. What else we got going on?
The main point.
The meat on the bones. The ham section of the podcast. Yeah, the bones. So yeah.
The meat.
Should we just get straight into it?
Just bones. Sure.
So what's the meat of the episode this week, Gemma?
The meat this week, Benjamin, is we're going to talk about the prevalence of mental health issues. We know that it's taboo, which is why we're doing this podcast in the first place and clearly think that it shouldn't be. I'm trying to break down those barriers. And also how certain conditions, focusing on your own, because that's the topic in which you are an expert, has been exacerbated by lockdown.
Yes, and as I understand it as well, the numbers have changed somewhat, haven't they? Because before it was around about the 1 in 4 mark that would experience mental health issues. Is it over a period of a year?
Well, I haven't found comparative statistics yet.
Right.
But I used to volunteer with, and I suppose only don't at the moment because of lockdown, with the Time to Change campaign, and indeed, I've gone to road shows and things like that, and the statistics that we were given there and also on the mental health first aid course that I did is that 1 in 4 people in any given year suffer from a mental health issue. The most recent statistic I've seen is that 1 in 6 people in the past week. So obviously overall that sounds like fewer people, but the time frame is completely different. So they're not comparable.
I wonder if there are statistics available that include cases of mental health issues with children.
There almost certainly are.
Because I think that number would be higher.
I think it would definitely be higher. You mean this year with the circumstances?
Yeah, but just
not
in general,
higher than adults necessarily. Oh, you think it would be?
Yeah, but then it's very hard to get a concise view on what mental illness they're suffering from if it's nothing obvious. Whether trauma.
Yeah, I think it's much harder to diagnose in children.
Because they lie. They do lie.
Well, they're imaginative creatures.
Mm-hmm. I think it's safe to say that lockdown has had quite the impact on the nation. Well, scratch that. The world's mental health. But focusing more locally, this country's mental health. And I think that people who have not suffered before have probably suffered for the first time. Through financial stress, from losing their job, through anxiety over the pandemic.
And that we get no cow in sunshine.
I don't think that's as important to other people as it is to you.
I think it's important to everybody. Season affective disorder. I said cow in, yeah.
Black Country Museum.
Do you do that thing on the barge when you push the barge along the brick tunnel thing with your feet?
I don't know, because last time I went, I was actually at school.
That's what I'm talking about.
I can't remember that far back.
You think I went as an adult and did the thing on a barge?
You've been places like as an adult.
I have not been to the Black Country Museum.
You've been on trips,
no offence to the Black Country Museum. It's grand.
That reminds me of Masai Graham's joke.
Don't.
No, I'm not going to say it, but he's a comedy genius.
He is. We love you, Masai.
We do love you, Masai. Yeah, it's... And I've seen it. I've seen
Can I? No, I can't. I wanted to say my favourite joke of his, but I can't even say that. Speaking of kids.
I have seen it in such close quarters as well, how it's impacted on people's mental health. Friends, colleagues, it's really starting to show.
Do you know what I think, actually, this year, because of lockdown and because people are talking about it more, and very tragically back in, I think it was February, when Caroline Flack took her own life and we had the whole Be Kind movement.
Which was wonderful.
It was wonderful. Tragic that it had to happen. But I think that for the first time, actually lockdown and the restrictions and people knowing that they haven't got those social circles and, you know, support networks that they're used to, that people feel more comfortable for once actually talking about it. It's kind of, you know, it's being spoken about so much more that lockdown has helped people to go, do you know what, I'm struggling.
And yeah, just be honest, be candid about it. Yeah,
and it's not that they weren't before, it's just that they feel almost more validated.
Yeah,
which is sad in itself, but still a good, you know, it's still progressive. And I'm happy that people are talking about it more. But yeah, I don't necessarily think that more people are struggling with mental health issues because of lockdown. I think that the people who were already struggling are struggling worse, but feel more able to talk about it. And that's a double-edged sword, isn't it? Feeling worse, but being able to talk about it. I hope they're just reaching out and getting the help that's available.
I have not looked at it from that perspective. And if that is the case, I know, which I hope it is, then that something incredibly positive has come out of lockdown. On a more personal note, one of the things that I've found, anybody that knows me knows that I'm not a fan of communicating on the phone. I don't like video calls. I was very awkward communicating with people because it's just one of those things. I just didn't like doing it. I analysed everything I said afterwards. This has forced me to pick up the phone, answer the phone, video call people. And it wasn't because I couldn't be bothered before. It was just a bit of a dirt merchant when it comes to keeping in touch with people. But yeah, it's forced me to conquer a few of my own anxieties, which were really good, but then a pandemic to get me to answer my phone to my friends. But I'm doing it now, so stop moaning.
I am already aware in just episode 2 of what an annoying optimist I am, which my dad will rejoice at, because I always say I'm a realist and he's like, you're an optimist, and I go, no, you're negative, and what's the pessimist. That's it. We both think we're realists, but actually we're probably at extremes of the scale. But I don't think you were forced to. I think you were compelled to. I think
it's not the same thing.
No, forcing and compelling, no, not at all.
One's just
compelling is encouraging a behavior which somebody knows they should probably do anyway. Forcing is, you know, making someone do so. It's not the same. I don't think it's the same. Anyway, I don't think you were forced to start answering your phone and doing video calls. I think you were compelled to, because as difficult as that was before, the relationships with the people you care about are more important than how bad it made you feel or how anxious it made you feel to pick up the phone. And also because, of course, you're not selfish at all, even when you are incredibly low, you're not selfish. You know that there are people in your life who are also struggling, and even if you're having a really shitty day and the last thing you need is to speak to someone on the phone, they might need you to.
Yes, and it's incredibly nice of you to say that, and I appreciate that that's been noticed. But yeah, it's the being in contact with the people is far more important than the anxiety of actually just picking the phone up. I couldn't live myself if somebody called me wanting to speak to me because they were struggling and I didn't answer the phone. It's just not, for a couple of seconds of discomfort and talking at the same time, like I always do on the phone with people, I've got over that, I think. But it's It's just one of the peccadilloes that comes along with my particular brand of depression.
I will say, however, that even though we'll not deliberately avoid anybody's phone call if they're trying to call because they're having a tough time, he's absolutely fucking deaf. So if he doesn't hear it, that's not the same.
Yeah, yeah. But sometimes I'll check my phone. And if you're not in the top three of people that I like, I won't return your call.
Who's the top three? Your mum.
Your mum? Ooh, too soon. No, I'm not disclosing that. You'll have to find out. You're definitely in the top three.
Am I in the top three? Well, he's not confirming whether I'm number one or not. That's good.
No. Correct me if I'm wrong, because I know sometimes you struggle with that. Has your mental health been affected by lockdown? I know you struggled with the lack of sun and the opportunity to holiday.
Yeah.
But has it affected your mental health?
I don't really think so.
Let's move on then.
The trouble is, huh?
Let's move on.
Fuck you. I think because the training that I've done obviously focuses on specific issues within mental health, you know, obviously depression, suicidal ideation, eating disorders, people from the LGBT plus community, that because I don't identify with any of those, I find it hard to kind of get. I mean, I spoke last time about the time when I definitely suffered from the ill effects of stress.
Yes.
For the first time. And it affected my sleep, and I felt like I was losing control, I suppose, and I just about nipped it in the bud. And I think I was only able to do that because of the training that I'd had and that I identified it in myself, which was very lucky. But no, not really. I mean, because we're both key workers, in inverted commas, and have worked throughout, it's affected me very little, really. And because of my fibromyalgia and my skin hurting all the time, I'd rather video call everyone I know every day forever than have someone hug me. I understand it's important for them, but no, I'm like, touch me, man.
But you know, it's funny you should say that, because I was going to suggest virtual lovemaking.
In Demolition Man?
Yes. Oh, nice reference. Yeah.
You're welcome.
Yeah, because then you have the phone downstairs.
I'm fantasising about Simon Phoenix smashing that guy's head off the Perspex in
like
the museum.
You like that far too much,
it's
don't you?
Like, I made a meme. Not a meme, what's it called? A gif.
Yes.
I made a gif of that.
That's the hardest I've heard you laugh. When I remember we were watching that, you were like, this is dross, this wouldn't happen. What year is this supposed to be? And then when that happened, you lost your mind.
Oh, it's just beautiful.
You're such a fan of violence.
Well, no, it's just, it's silly as well, because it bounces, because it's clearly not glass.
Anyway, we digress. Anyway, I did see how important it is for you to go away and be on holiday and get some sun.
Yeah, I do have a bit of a Judith Chalmers reputation, but people don't understand if they just don't know about the condition, fibromyalgia, that being in a warm, dry country for even a week just before winter makes such a difference to me, and not being able to do that has had a really big impact. I've been incredibly lucky though, because my employers, wherever possible, have allowed me to work from home. So at least if I can't get on holiday, I can hide from the weather here.
Yeah, and I don't think it hurts as well that you go away without me to these countries that are full of abbed up, mega peckered bromos that like dancing with you and holding your hand and looking into your eyes and saying stuff, sexy stuff. Like, well, the kind of stuff that Shaggy would say.
I had stuff to say before you asked that question.
Okay, go on then.
Well, to quote my late mother, but with a slight name change, the name Slaughter, not Rockefeller, I can't afford to go on holiday in school holidays.
No, I understand that. I don't have any issue with you going away without
me. Sounds like it.
I don't. Yeah, so we are under no illusions how difficult the lockdown has been, and having seen it firsthand with quite a few people that are very, very important to me, it's vital that we're there for people. And if you can't be, it's not a problem. It's not essential that you spend your days making yourself available for people and supporting people, because you need to be supported as well. But it's so evident that there are people out there that require intervention, support, just to know that there's someone there thinking of them, especially coming up to Christmas as well.
I don't know what advert it was. There was an advert on the TV and there was a lady talking, and she says, you know, they're doing like the video calls and whatever, and it's, but it's a poem. It might be a bank.
Oh, it's now, is it, is a it, Nationwide? It's Nationwide. I think it's Nationwide.
I don't know.
It's probably not
other banks are available. And she, you know, she says, oh, you know, we're all video calling and ask, how are you? And we really mean that.
Yes, yes,
and,
we
and
do.
That's, you know, how you could easily get bummed out by the notion that actually asking that question and waiting for the answer is only relevant in a pandemic.
But
it just makes you appreciate things. I think you're hyper alert to the fact that people will probably suffer. Let's remember that everybody's not the same, but most people do crave some level of interaction with other humans. In general, I think people are more aware
that
you know, folk are struggling. So it's not all doom and gloom, although I do think that it's exacerbated things for people who are already suffering from mental health issues.
Yes, it has exacerbated them, but you have to take the positives. I agree with what you just said. There are more people asking, how are you? And I know for a fact.
It.
Yeah, meaning it, listening. This is going to be the part of the show where we discuss the feedback that we've received. Good friend of mine, Gemma Hurst, who is part of the Skip to the End podcast. She also has the Reimagined Twitter page, which is absolutely awesome. She said she really enjoyed the podcast and appreciated the honesty and how candid we were. So thank you very much, Gemma.
Our wonderful friend Sharon, who is one of our NHS heroes, said that this podcast has it all, that she laughed, sobbed and learned new things about us too and also about herself, and that it's okay to not be okay is never more evident than now. Thank you, Sharon.
A follower on Twitter, Todd Murgatroyd, who has got a fantastic name. I'm assuming it's not his proper name. If it is, it's probably better than ours.
Oh, I hope it is.
Murgatroyd. That's brilliant.
It's better than ours.
So Todd Murgatroyd said, it was absolutely incredible. Whatever I was expecting, I got, and more. It was informative, interesting, and genuinely entertaining. Thank you very much, Todd. We appreciate your kind words.
We want to inspire conversation. We want to get people talking about something that they wouldn't normally talk about. And so we had some great feedback. And I don't mean great as in positive, because some of it wasn't necessarily so. People were letting us know what they hoped we would talk about, and a particular one was that they hoped you would expand a little bit on what your particular diagnosis is.
The most adored teacher in Stourbridge, a very, very good friend of ours, Mr. Alan Bennett, one of the things that he picked up on, which we really, really appreciated, was the first episode I mentioned that I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder and then just carried on talking about everything else. I feel very comfortable in divulging some more information about my diagnosis. In its purest sense, bipolar disorder is extreme mood swings. That's not my particular brand, and this is really important. When we talk about depression or mental health issues, it's not one size fits all. It's not, I have this, so whenever you mention depression, that's what you'll have. Thanks to your, I don't know whether it's, you're very acute in your observations, but it's the way you explain it to me. I didn't realise that I had no middle ground. So for what I perceived to be normal, I would go from pure ecstasy to suicidal thoughts, palpable depression, couldn't function, couldn't think straight. We're not just talking negativity, and I'm not saying that I was a bit sad. My happy and my sad were so extreme, unbelievably extreme, that I didn't know what it was like to feel that bit in between. You pointed that out to me, and it made me realise that, you know, I've been surviving for so long, being the happiest I've ever felt one moment, and just utter despair the next. And I just generally thought that's what people felt. I have a deficiency in like regularity, a deficiency in what people would consider to be a base level of not just happiness, but I don't want to say normality either. I just want to say
contentedness.
Like a, yes, yeah. So we all know that people get the Sunday blues, or people get unhappy when a good time's over. But my reaction to it was so abnormal, and you've experienced that with me. Certainly when we first got together, why is this guy? He's gone from flying one minute to dying the next. So what's?
I think the most obvious thing for us as a couple was that whenever something appeared like a happy family event, you know, a wedding, yeah, a christening or whatever, anything, a birthday party, that for most of our nearly 11 years so far, I know that you are going to become really depressed and probably have what we would refer to within our couple as an episode.
Yeah.
And kick off and cause a scene and make things difficult. And the thing is, I mean, when I say make a scene, I don't mean for everybody there and that everybody's aware. Just you. And that's, well, you know, that's something that's very particular. Well, I don't know that it is. I feel like it's very particular to our situation that most people have absolutely no idea that whenever we go to any kind of event that's supposed to be happy and exciting, that you are almost certainly going to have a really difficult, depressive event that's going to consume everything to do with me at that time. And they genuinely have no idea. Sometimes they find out months down the line, they're like, oh, really? It was, you had that kind of time? But there are still people now whose weddings and children's christenings and all sorts, they have absolutely no idea that it was a really, really difficult time for us because we do so very well at hiding it.
I agree. And I think using one of the more recent revelations, I think it was to Melanie.
Your sister.
Or it might have been to one of your friends. When we divulged that every time we've been on holiday or every time we've had an event where it was supposed to be enjoyable, I was, and let's not dress it up now, I was a dickhead to you and I was a dickhead to be around for a long, long time. There were holidays that you could guarantee at some point I would have, I don't want to say an episode, I'd have a, I would cause a situation and I would be horrible to you. I would make a scene. And when I say make a scene, not in front of anyone else, just you. I would ruin things. And as somebody who is a depressional, nailed it. As someone who's a depressional, I bask in those moments because I think that's what I deserve. I deserve to have a selection of ruined memories. I deserve to have you upset with me. I deserve to have you angry with me because I've ruined something. And yet again, you deduced the whole behaviour into what?
Oh, well, I understood that you didn't think that you deserved anything good to happen to you. Whenever, I mean, big family occasions aside, because they can be stressful for just about everybody, but holidays and stuff, you think, well, it's just the two of us, you know, just chill out and have a good time. But you couldn't do that because you, within yourself, in your subconscious, didn't understand or didn't believe that you deserved to have a good, enjoyable time. And I get that, but I needed a holiday.
Yes, yeah. And, you know, let's be honest, there were times when I...
Everyone's like, what a selfish bitch.
There are times, and unfortunately, your experience has had a tattoo of my disorder on it. I am far more comfortable talking about it now because before, and this is going to be quite a strange thing for people to try and understand, I sort out negativity, I sort out disruption, I sort out arguments, and I can unequivocally state now that the things that happened were never a result of what you did. I just felt like things were going too well and people were too happy. So I felt that it was something I needed to impose on, and I'm not proud of it, and you know that.
How conscious was that?
It's a tough question. Retrospectively, I'd like to believe that it was an unconscious decision, but there are things that I've identified in myself through talking to a therapist, through talking to you, through listening to you. I believe that half of it was subconscious and half of it was conscious. I believe there are times when I went out of my way to ruin things purely because, and this is not how I feel now, but purely because the way I felt, I wanted everyone to feel that way. How's my mental health condition affected you, Gemma? Try your hardest to be honest as well. I know you struggle with that.
That's the thing I'm struggling with the most, because most normal folk can't deal with my level of honesty. And I wish I was exaggerating, but I'm not.
To be honest, I'm just...
There are so many circumstances where it just appears like a class clown situation. Everyone's like, oh, Ben's so funny, he's so nice, he's so sociable. And you are wonderful and you are very, very funny. But when you are at the peak of that kind of performance,
everybody else. Don't laugh. Because
I'm only scoffing because that's exactly what it is.
It is. It's the peak of a performance. And the only time you really are at your best in that way is when internally and mentally you're at your worst. And the people who experience that at parties or on nights out have absolutely no idea. And then as soon as you're away from that environment, which almost always will be you and I in a taxi heading back somewhere, and we've had probably some of our most difficult moments in taxis heading back somewhere, and you just crash, you can't maintain it, and your world begins to crash in around you, and you know that you've been portraying something that you're not for several hours, and it's exhausting, and you just want to go to bed, but you're also inebriated. And when you don't know how to deal with that, you don't have the tools, and it's really difficult, and you're drunk, you direct that to the person that's closest to you, and that is almost always me. And that's okay, you know. There's times when I see it coming a mile away, and I just withdraw and almost wait for the sandstorm. That's the reality. But that's on nights out, and then most of the time we're in the house, we're not drunk, and we're not around other people, and you're not pretending to be something that you're not, and you just have days where you need to have headphones on all day, or you need to be busy. I mean, I need to be busy, but you need to be busy, you know, mind and hands and everything. You need to be doing something all day long, but that's all right. I truly believe it would have been exponentially more difficult had we had children, because we both grew up around people who struggle with their mental health, and you see it. You see that not only are they absent for large swathes of things where you think they should probably be involved, but when you're an adult and you can look back on that, you can say they must have felt so awful that they couldn't contribute and they couldn't be part of that. And actually, we're really lucky that we don't have that burden and that guilt. But I know there's even days when you feel dreadful because you just cannot face walking the dogs. And, you know, that's something that someone who's never struggled with mental health could ever even contemplate. And they would probably think you're being a bit over the top, you're being melodramatic, you could pull yourself out of it. And it just isn't like that. And people need to cop on.
I'm not going to lie. Some of the things you said struck me quite hard.
Like what?
Just definitely weren't saying anything with any hostile intent. I didn't realise that it was so clear for you to see. And also, I take umbrage with the fact that you said trying to be funny. That really upsets me. Of all the things you said, okay. No, I'm only joking. There was one thing that struck me was I didn't realise that the performance thing is, as difficult it is to admit, the performance term is absolutely nailed on. And it is a performance, and it's something that you do because you hope nobody asks you the question or somebody sees past that facade. And because you did, I reverted back to how I really felt on taxi rides home or drives back home. Ultimately, you had to cop for that. And I do carry a tremendous amount of guilt. And there are things that I will never forget. And you have always maintained that it's fine. It's something that's happened. You understand that it's an illness. You understand that sometimes I can't control that. But I have to be honest, there are things that I'll never forget, and instances where I've really upset you and attacked you emotionally. But you just cut to the core then. That is something I will always appreciate and never take for granted. You always cut to the core. And if I was with somebody who wasn't as candid and as grounded as you are, and I was with somebody that either told me something that I needed to hear. I know you do, you treat me like a king, you make me feel like a king, but when it comes to the crunch, when I really need it, when I need to be told, you do that. And I never realised how transparent my behaviour was when I was depressed to you. Not to everyone, but to you, because you genuinely knew who I was. You knew everything about me. I am absolutely fine with it being considered a performance, because that is exactly what it was. Now it's time for, oh, that's not true, mate, the section of the podcast where we dismantle shit house lies and myths about mental health. We butter the toast of misinformation with straight up fact preserves, corners and all. Do you know when you were in the army, were there initiations like filling socks full of soaps?
I'm not in the army.
You know when you joined the army, Were there any initiations like filling socks full of soaps and beating the shit out of people the week?
I'm still not in the army.
This episode, we are going to talk about something which is quite controversial, and hopefully it will stimulate some conversation between me and my hog of a wife. And that myth, that belief we're talking about today is what, Gemma?
That people who take their own lives are selfish.
Indeed. Now, earlier on today, or it might have been last night actually, we were having a conversation with our close friend. And I didn't know this. You told me that the term committing suicide originates from an act of criminality.
Of course, yeah.
So the preferred term is taking your own life.
Well, in suicide intervention circles, which is the lamest thing I've probably ever said, they use the term complete suicide. But we had an additional conversation about this and we think it sounds a little bit like playing a computer game and being like, you know, like, oh,
well,
Sonic
done
or something. Yeah, I've completed suicide. And I know, I understand the motivations of them choosing that word. Mm-hmm. And it's because it's not a criminal offence anymore. It shouldn't be viewed that way. But it's one of those terms that just permeates every aspect of life and everybody says it. And actually, it's indicative of something that's really quite hurtful, that it is an offence of some kind for someone who's just had enough.
That to me is a really, really important point. We will never know when somebody chooses to take their own life. We will never know exactly the reasons behind it. You only have to surmise, you have to guess. There's no concrete proof to explain why they did it. When someone does take their own life, there is a lot of questions left afterwards, a lot of guilt, and you've hit the nail on the head. I believe, my opinion, solely my opinion, it's when somebody has had enough, can no longer continue, and has just had their fill. And you said something the other day about it is the least selfish thing because...
Because in that moment, because after my mum took her own life, I decided to try and make the most miserable thing into any kind of positive, that I trained in suicide intervention. And so many people that I've spoken to since have been on the verge of making that choice, or even in the moment of making that choice, sometimes it's been that close. But they are never, ever thinking of themselves. They are never thinking that it's going to be a difficulty for the people that they leave behind. They truly believe in that moment that the world they leave behind will be better off without them, that everybody they know and love will be better off without them, that they are a burden. You can't, and I have never managed, and I don't want to try, to put myself into the same mind space that those people are in. But I think we can try really, really hard to understand where they are in that moment. And Ben knows this, that the vast majority of the people that I end up connecting with in a suicide intervention way is because I chance upon a discussion online. And it's almost always that people are explaining how desperate they are and how difficult they're finding things.
Your intervention with a lot of people has almost been serendipitous. It's the right place and the right time, and that person has suffered enough. And to think that we as a collective are accusing them of being selfish because of the things they could have lived for, bearing in mind they no longer believe that they have a reason to live, accusing them of being selfish is the last disrespect, and we should never do that.
I agree to an extent, but I don't feel that it's an accusation. I feel like it's an act of desperation on the part of people who can see that something is probably imminent. And so it's more reaching out and saying, please don't do this. I can see the direction you're heading in. But they don't quite know how to articulate it. I kind of stalk chronic pain groups, and it's very, very common for people with chronic pain to suffer from depression and eventually from suicidal ideation. And so I just pick up on things, and there are so many people who just have days where they say, I'm done, fucking hell, like this is too much, I don't know how I'm going to go another day with this much pain and this much fatigue and nobody around me really understanding anything. And when I pick up on it, it's always when people who they know comment and say, think of your kids, think yep. of blah, blah, blah. And it,
it but just, that's all those people are doing. They're thinking about everybody else.
It's the opposite of, yeah, it's not that they're not thinking of those people. So I will reach out to the individual in a direct message and try and get them to engage with me. I don't know whether I said this before or not, but it's an unpopular...
Almost controversial.
Almost controversial, I suppose, view in the suicide intervention world. But I don't believe at all that every suicide is preventable. I think in the moment when somebody is considering that or in the act of doing that, of course you can intervene if you walk in on somebody. But if somebody really, really has just had enough and they want to go, that they're going to do that regardless. Yeah, and you can't beat yourself up over that. You have to focus on the positives. If you save one life
yep.
in your meagre existence, it's better than nothing.
And it's hard to accept that is the only route for people. And especially if it's a family member, a close friend, there will always be that moment where you think, shit, could I have stopped this? But like you pointed out, and I do agree with you that not all suicides are preventable, but I strongly, firmly, vehemently believe that we can reduce the amount of suicides just by small gestures, small acts, where we don't demonize it, we don't,
and not criminalizing it. If you don't say, you don't use the phrase committing suicide, because the only when else would you use the word commit
in crime
or insanity. to an asylum? That's it.
Or to marriage.
Crime or no, that's not.
Well, I commit myself to you, but yes, it's it is raw. It's upsetting. It's the fact that it leaves the people behind with so many questions. I think that's where the accusation stems from. It's the hurt and not being able to find out why. And now it's time for preposterous past procedures.
Hey!
Is it really first time?
Yeah.
Woohoo!
Amazing.
It is Gemma's turn this week. I don't know what she's going to talk about. Hopefully it'll have more to do with mental health than mine did last week. A few people pointed out.
Well, it's definitely something that was used to treat what were perceived as mental health conditions, but it's just a cacophony of nonsense.
I am rigid. Are we going to get going?
All right. Are you ready?
Hold on. Yes.
Okay. You'll know the condition, definitely. You will have heard of it. But I think if you'd heard of the treatment, that it would have come up in conversation at some point when we're sitting drinking in the kitchen on a Saturday. And it hasn't. So I'm going to assume that you don't know.
Okay. I'm intrigued.
Hysteria.
Oh, yeah.
What do you know about hysteria?
It's a fantastic news song. I also know that there was a film or a book that I read or saw that was about women having, I don't know whether they people thought they were hysterical because they were having orgasms or they were orgasming. Is that orgasming? Or they were having orgasms because they were hysterical. So I don't know that much about it. I don't know much about orgasms either.
Evidently.
Dude.
So that's the extent of your knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's great. I'm
glad you think so.
I'm going to start from a linguistic angle, because you know I love those.
Okay.
So gynecology is a Greek term, literally meaning the study of women.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And hysteria
mm-hmm.
is derived from the word hystera, which means womb.
I did not know that.
I didn't know that until I researched
hysteria.
Hysteria, yeah. And this, according to the Royal College of Nursing, this linguistic association between women's health and hysteria is still used today in the term hysterectomy.
Oh, yeah. Do you know, I love learning things.
I love learning
especially
things.
About disgusting things like wombs. I'm not Googling what a womb is.
Good. For our American listeners, it's a uterus.
Honestly, that's fascinating.
Yeah, I love a little bit of a language.
hold on, no, we can't. I love the bit of language. something. You're dumb.
I love a bit of language.
Oh, yeah. Language me up. Come on then, let's go.
Your definition of hysteria was wildly inaccurate.
Hold on. Shock.
Shock, yeah. Essentially, in ancient times.
Oh, no.
A long, long time ago. Wait, because your man gets a mention in a moment, so I think you should calm yourself. Women suffering from pretty much any type of mental illness were considered victims of hysteria.
Okay.
And the Greek physician, Hippocrates.
Hippocrates!
Popularized the term. There were lots of things that they thought were parts of hysteria, so fainting fits and spontaneous muteness being one of my favourites. I'd just be like, I just can't, and just be never quiet. Like, what the fuck are you? I get that, spontaneous muteness.
No, you don't.
I do, because otherwise I would set people on fire.
No, that's not spontaneous. That's definitely a considered action.
Well.
Spontaneous mute. I'd love to do that. So you're just talking like I'm that. And that's me done then. Can I also say.
Hysterical bitch. We've done etymology.
Oh, yeah.
What the condition is.
So just fainting and being quiet.
No, not just that. Those were parts of hysteria. So, you know, just any womanly thing. Tantrums. ironing. I don't know. I don't know what the fuck they were thinking. But, you know, hysteria was so, purely for women.
So when he says, you've just told me, like, popularized. I'm assuming when they use the term popularized, they just mean they used it enough for people to go, oh, that sounds like a thing.
Yeah. 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 So people said it. You know, like, when a word goes into the dictionary these days, like hashtag.
It's popular. Yeah. So he could have just been walking around. If it's Hippocrates, it's Greece, isn't it?
Yeah.
So just walking around Greece going, well, that's hysteria. That's hysteria. Just pointing to, like, a bin.
No, you know, it had to be related to women who
Johnny
were...
Johnny is the tramp. No, I know, but, like, if you're popularised, just using it enough.
Yeah, and you have credibility.
That's where I've been going wrong.
Almost unbelievably when you listen to the rest of this story. But credibility and people think, okay, you know, he knows what he's talking about. Hippocrates, I'm just going to say...
Yes.
Say
properly, because otherwise I'll go through my entire life saying Hippocrates.
Yeah. Theorised that the root cause of hysteria... was a wandering womb. Like, just roving about the place.
As in to wander? As in to move?
Yeah,
to...
roaming around, like not staying in
as
its
in,
place.
I'm off, mate.
Well, not off, not like out of the body and,
no, no,
and getting on a train.
That would be stupid. But like, oh, let's go for a walk about pancreas.
Yeah, something like that.
Hippocrates has gone down in my estimation. He sounds like a dickhead.
But then, see, just dudes. Because like, then his mate Plato comes along.
Plato?
Yeah. And...
Wasn't that the name of Popeye's nemesis in the cartoon Popeye?
Pluto.
Oh, Pluto. Oh,
yeah,
shame.
Not the...
I know, just...
I'm so embarrassed of you right now. Have you not watched Muppet Christmas Carol with me 46,000 times and seen the shelf with the scholars? It's got like Shakespeare, Plato... Man.
I have brought great shame on this podcast. I apologise. So Plato isn't... Carry on.
Plato was curious about Hippocrates' theory.
Okay.
And he claimed that if the womb remains unfruitful long beyond its proper time, it gets discontented and angry and wanders in every direction through the body.
Oh, they straight up got with me, didn't they?
It gets more extravagant.
When you say unfruitful, do you mean...
So not bearing spawn.
Okay. Oh, it's going to be more graphic, but that's fine.
Okay. Yeah, wanders in every direction through the body, closes up passages of breath, and by...
Which obviously leads to the fainting and muteness.
Yeah. And by obstructing respiration, drives women to extremity. This is clearly hilarious. And as a psychiatric treatment, I'll go into what they did.
Yes,
to,
please do.
To scare it away, essentially. But this lasted until the early 20th century.
I was just about to ask, how much of this bullshit do you think informed medical science to a point?
It absolutely did.
That's incredible.
And I... Maybe it's a bit of a stretch... I don't know, but the treatment
that
they employed was holding foul-smelling substances under the under the woman's nose to drive the uterus away from the chest. And do you know what? I think if there was any if there was any value in this, we could pimp Lucy out.
Oh,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Her just hover her backside under people's faces.
It's muddy.
She'd cure every wandering womb in the land.
There would be no WWs.
They wouldn't.
So they would hold something stank under their nose, which would make the womb retreat.
Yeah, just like run away from the chest area.
What's the worst
so
thing
wasn't...
you can think of that you wouldn't want to smell to get your womb to fix up and look sharp? I tell you what, if I had a womb, the worst smell for me.
Why is it different if you've got a womb?
Okay, come on. What?
What's the worst smell?
The worst smell for me is a festival poor loo on a Monday morning.
Yeah, I think I'd see your festival Portaloo and I'd raise it with one in Basra at lunchtime in August.
Oh, yeah. Okay, all right. You win. Actually, I think Brendan, Matt and my sister Kira would attest that my post-breakfast wrap guffs were pretty upsetting. We are well off topic here. Let's get back onto womb issues, wishes. Go on.
I do quite like that they referred to it overall as womb calming.
Womb calming?
Yeah, I like that. It's just a cute little phrase for absolute nonsense. But Plato, not the buddy from Popeye, mm-hmm. believed that the only surefire way to solve the problem was to get married and have babies.
Oh, obviously. Mm. Obviously. This bullshit. It is tattooed onto our history where men have monopolized or had the monopoly on women's bodies from thousands and thousands of years ago. Obviously, it still goes on now. So in order for you to sort yourself out, get yourself a man, get yourself some children.
Yep. The Royal College of Nursing site further adds that a wandering womb caused suffocation and death, and menstruation and pregnancy were thought to make women the weaker sex, both physically and mentally. And I'd like to say, on behalf of everyone with a womb, get fucked.
Yes, yes, indeed. That is some next level nonsense.
Yeah.
It definitely trumps thought. Oh.
This is a great phrase, and it's because of one word in it, that women's biology made them less rational than men, unfit to participate in many areas of public life.
That's, unfortunately, it's not surprising, but that is emancipation at its finest. Emancipation through education and bollocks, that is. Emancipation through education and philosophy.
Stop saying emancipation.
No, I like it. Stop talking away from the microphone, you peanut-headed freak.
I didn't. I looked at you and then I turned away.
Any more? No? Right, any more, Gemma?
No, I don't think so, if you're done with that.
Okay. So what is your prognosis on wandering wombs?
Prognosis?
What is your feelings about wandering wombs and Hippocrates?
I said, what is your feelings?
So how do you feel about wandering wombs and Hippocrates and Plato just sitting around talking guff?
I wish mine would fucking wander.
Yeah.
It's a right pain in the ass.
It's wandered. Yeah, I know. I know, bad.
Maybe that's the problem. It's just been in my ass all this time.
Maybe you need
to
smell something.
It hurts so much. It's in your ass.
You need to smell something disgusting. No, it is. It's nonsense.
That is definitely not a cure in that case. Nah. If I have a wandering womb with the amount of dog ass in this house, no way.
Thank you for that. It was very, very enlightening, a little bit frightening, but quite funny.
Oh, I thought you were going to go into like a queen thing.
Thank you very much, Gemma.
You're most welcome.
So there you have it. That is the, what do we call it? The wandering womb?
Yeah.
No, it's hysteria, isn't it?
It is hysteria.
So that is one of the most peculiar past, I've just made another one up. That
peculiar
is a preposterous, I think that's one that you said, peculiar past, but anyway. Thank you for that preposterous past procedure, Gemma. It was much, much better than mine last week. And I've learned some new things about women. There you go. There's some more background about my depression, what I have experienced, the things I've learned. And also, that's some more background information on what Gemma's had to deal with being with me. And I'm not saying that in a kind of, oh, I'm so sorry for you. I'm saying that as in it's a shared experience. It's not me suffering on my own. You suffer with me too.
Thanks for listening, folks. Let us know what you think. See you next week. No, not next week.
What?